Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Chamber Music Tulsa's next program will feature an unusual collaboration between mentor and mentees as they present the Miro Quartet and the Aeolus Quartet, playing the octet for strings by Mendelssohn and a work for two antiphonal quartets by contemporary composer Dan Welker. Both Welker and the Miro Quartet are in residence at the University of Texas. Several years earlier, the Aeolus Quartet, fresh out of undergraduate school, were in residence with the Miro in their young professional string quartet program. They're now in residence at Juilliard and are completing a week-long residency in Tulsa, playing all over town this week, which will culminate in the Sunday afternoon performance. My guest today is the founding member of the Miro Quartet, cellist Joshua Gindel. The Miro is one of America's top chamber ensembles, winning both the Banff and Naumburg Chamber Music Competitions, and they were the first group to receive the Avery Fisher Career Grant. They perform all over the world, all over the country on a regular basis. They're frequent guests here in northeastern Oklahoma at the OK Mozart Festival, as well as Chamber Music Tulsa. And on this Sunday's program, which will be at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus, the Miro will play the Beethoven Quartet No. 1 and will be joined by their former students, the Aeolus, for Welker's Musion Polemos and the Mendelssohn Octet. Joshua Gindel is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Joshua Gindel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
The Miro, you seem to have a great rapport with this part of the state. You've appeared here many times at Chamber Music Tulsa, at OK Mozart, of course, now back with Chamber Music Tulsa this weekend. And this is a very unusual program where you're performing with another quartet. How did this particular program come about?
Well, the people at Chamber Music Tulsa we've known for some time, and we've kept pretty close touch. We always have a great time when we come up there. And one of the things we made them aware of, this is a number of years ago, is that we had an apprenticeship program here at the University of Texas in Austin, where we bring in young professional groups, professional string quartets that are kind of on the cusp of a career of some sort, and we bring in and mentor them and coach them. And Bruce, who runs Chamber Music Tulsa, heard and met one of our groups that had graduated called the Aeolus Quartet, and we had mentored them for 2 years here, and then they went on to go to D.C. and New York, and he thought it would be kind of a fun idea to bring the quartets together and have sort of a teacher student concert, but they're no longer students, of course, but sort of a mentorship program. And, you know, the octet literature, although it's fairly limited, the literature for two string quartets, there is some really great, great works. And so it seemed like an obvious choice. And I know that he had sort of the conception around the Aeolus coming in and doing a week of residency activities, outreach concerts and community events, things like that, and then having us come in and perform with them at the end of that. So that's how this all kind of came together. It's been in discussion for a number of years now.
And it's really kind of a cool thing. The Mendelssohn Octet gets performed every now and again, but most of the time, but it's a string orchestra, not in that true octet format. It's not often you hear two string quartets working together. And in this particular program, two different pieces. The Mendelssohn Octet is just a wonderful piece.
Yeah, it's great. He wrote it really young. And you know, the thing that's so nice about having two quartets that have some experience playing together, and obviously we know the Aeolus quite well because we were their teachers for many years, but is you can kind of put it together with a level of intricacy and detail that you can't normally do with a group of, let's say, eight random individuals playing or a string orchestra. And because the writing is so brilliant and the counterpoint is so clear and well-conceived, even by an 18-year-old Mendelssohn, when you really get a group that's really tight, there's a certain transparency and certain classical element to the piece that doesn't usually come off when the piece is performed in other settings. So I think that's what makes this special. And I think for us, too, just to be on stage with our former students and, you know, to see them grow and become this group, you know, and mature, I think that's also really pretty exciting.
Now, Aeolus is now in residency at Juilliard. They spent 2 years at the University of Texas program where you operate. Do you keep in touch with those members of the quartet, or have they pretty much flown the coop and they're doing their own thing now?
No, we keep in touch. They reach out to us for advice, and when we can, and if there's a geographical, if there's some similarity in geography between us, we'll go watch them play. So I know my colleague Daniel, our first violinist, heard them play not too long ago in the D.C. area. But it's also kind of interesting because they're in the residency that we did almost 20 years ago, so at Juilliard. And so they're sort of following in that footstep. So we know exactly what's going on there, and we know what they're going through and know what that involves and entails. And so I think they also kind of lean on us periodically for some advice regarding the New York music scene and Juilliard as a school, you know, very familiar to us.
Right. And I would assume right after that, you did that residency. That's when you sort of did the competition circuit. And of course, that's how you cemented your reputation by winning practically every chamber music competition around in that early years of your quartet.
Yeah, it was all integrated because as we were students, we were doing them. So The big international competition, actually, we won right before we went to Juilliard. And then some of the New York-based things like the Naumburg Prize or the Avery Fisher Career Grant, those were things that happened after we started at Juilliard.
Can you maybe put yourself in the ALS quartet's shoes? What are the sort of things they're thinking about as they really are getting their career established?
It's a tough road. I mean, it's funny. I was looking at their schedule because it was sent over to us. I remember those days. I remember showing up in a town and doing a week's worth of activity and doing a lot of outreach and a lot of, you know, community concerts and things like that. And that's what every great quartet did when they were younger. And persevering is the hardest thing because it really is about keeping the integrity of the group intact and making sure that your sort of interpersonal relations are good so you don't drive each other nuts. and then in the end, you know, kind of just pushing through the really difficult parts of the career. And, you know, we were all broke and we were all struggling and trying to, you know, pay our rent and just have to persevere. You just got to keep plugging away. And that's the hardest thing to do because it can be a little demoralizing sometimes.
Well, when you do one of these residencies, and the residency they're going to be doing here all this week involves places where you'll have a receptive audience, but they're also doing just sort of public gather events.
Right.
And, you know, I'm always struck by, you know, classical music in this day and age. You know, Joshua Bell can go into a subway station and play, you know, a Bach partita and, you know, people walk by and say, wow, that was a little better than normal, and that was about it, you know?
Right.
I mean, that can be really demoralizing, I think.
Yeah, I think you just need to do things with passion and things that you feel really strongly about and do them as well as you can. And in some ways, do them for yourself, too, because, you know, sometimes you're not going to have a receptive audience or sometimes, you know, the audience is going to be small and you have to find joy and love in what you do. And I think that's why most, you know, musicians do what they do is they love it, but you have to keep that in the forefront of your mind. Otherwise, those moments, you know, when you're being ignored or your audience is noisy or not very receptive, that is tough. So you got to just always remember why you do what you do.
Now, when you heard Aeolus, when they did your residency program, did you think you had someone special when the quartet came through?
You know, it's interesting. We hear a lot of good groups for this program, and you know, we've had a number of really, really nice groups. But the one thing that they had that was very palpable was a desire to do it. There wasn't any wavering by any single person in that group. And there was a real commitment to be a really fine string quartet and do things the right way, not take any shortcuts. And, you know, that goes a long way. I would say that I've seen lots of groups that have had an enormous amount of talent as far as the individual players are concerned, but they didn't have the commitment to one another, and they didn't have the commitment to the quartet literature and the quartet life. And the Aeolus has always had that. They had that from the very beginning when they were really young. And I think that's what really set them apart for us.
Well, we look forward to that appearance as Chamber Music Tulsa present the Miro Quartet. My guest today, Joshua Gindell, the cellist for the Miro Quartet, one of the founding members of the quartet, along with the Aeolus Quartet, this Sunday at 3 at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the University of Tulsa campus, playing two works for octet, and then the Miro will also play a Beethoven quartet. And Joshua is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, we talked a little bit about the Mendelssohn, just a gorgeous piece. You mentioned that it really does require that sort of chamber music mentality of four or eight people really knowing each other. And you talked about the idea that there's a bit more transparency when everybody knows it, knows how everybody's going to react. How do you get that? I mean, you guys obviously have heard each other play for several years, but it's been some time.
Right.
I know there are going to be some open rehearsals as you prepare on Friday and Saturday. What sort of things do you work out when you're fine-tuning a piece like that?
Well, the Mendelssohn Octet is a piece that we, the Muros, played a ton. So we have intimate knowledge of both sets of parts, not just the, you know, the first parts, which we'll be playing on Sunday, but also the second parts, because we've played them quite a bit as well. And I think understanding how the parts interact and when your voice is critical in the balance and when it's not, the better and more intimately you know this work, the easier that becomes, trying to find a balance between the two groups. So I think there'll be a lot of discussion about that. I think also, you know, we might yell at them a little bit. No, I'm just kidding. It's one of these dynamics that it just depends on the group. But because we all know each other so well, I really feel like the process of rehearsing that piece is going to be very streamlined and very, very simple. And we actually have played it with them before. So this is not the first foray into this collaboration. So this is, you know, we did it many years ago here in Austin. So there should be some, you know, remnants from those rehearsals as well.
Yeah. Now, the other piece is a relatively new piece, I believe, a couple years old, that you premiered by a University of Texas composer, Dan Welker, mm-hmm. called Musion Polemos.
Right.
And it sounds like, from his description, it's kind of like a gang fight for two quartets.
Yeah, it was written for us in the Shanghai Quartet, and we're all, again, old friends, and it was commissioned by the University of Texas. And it's a piece that was conceived because he saw the two personalities of the groups, the Muro Quartet and the Shanghai Quartet, as very different types of ensembles. And he sort of conceived it almost like a ballet, that there are two sets of characters, and one is a little more brutish and aggressive, and the other one is a little more elegant and I shouldn't say sweet, but not as rough around the edges. And so the groups actually sit separately on stage, and there's a little bit of theatrics around it. And it's been an incredible piece. We've actually played it a few times without the Shanghai, with some other ensembles. And it's great because you can rehearse as an ensemble, but also there's a lot of work that needs to be done as a quartet, because literally it's two rival quartets, essentially. And so it's a lot of fun. It's going to be, you know, it's a little complicated to put together. It is new music, and it is challenging. It has its moments, but it's a really effective piece. It's been incredible. We most recently did it in Miami, and it got a huge response. And it was, you know, we're really happy for Dan, and he's, I think, really thrilled with how the piece turned out.
We said he was inspired by Stravinsky, of all people. You know, he thinks of the, you know, the Rite of Spring sort of aggressive Stravinsky, but he says most of the piece is based on those neoclassical ballets he did in the late teens and 20s.
Right. There's a lot of Stravinsky-esque harmony, certainly, and also some of those driving rhythms that you're used to. But there's also a lot of that lilting, almost Baroque kind of material in there, too. The piece comes off incredibly well. And, when you commission a work, even from a composer like Dan, who's very well known and has done quite well in the music world, you don't really know what you're going to get. And it's always a really pleasant surprise when something comes out and it's really complete as a work. And this is really complete as a work. It's really quite stunning.
When you're doing something, a piece like that, that does involve a bit of theatrics in it, sometimes there could be a learning curve about, you know, really getting your head around that. Was that something that you had to work through in the rehearsal period, or did it really just, oh, wow, the first time you read through this, we understand this and how it works, and it works?
No, we you know, with a new piece, when you can sit down with a composer and really pick their brain about what it was they were intending, and then bring them into rehearsal and let them kind of help dictate the tone of the rehearsal, that makes a big difference. And because we sit separately on stage, there's some acoustical issues that we encounter, hearing each other across stage. But also there is actually some, and not overt, not sort of silly theatrics, but there's a little bit of kind of, there's like, you know, stare downs and stuff. And but it's not overt. Like, you wouldn't know it's happening, but it kind of helps set the tone for the relationship between the two groups. And, you know, in the end, the two groups actually come together to sing the same song, essentially. But that requires a little bit of effort, and it also depends on how open and how theatrical the group is. That we've noticed, you know, playing this with different groups, that some groups take much more naturally to something like this than others.
Yeah. Now, with the two warring quartets, do you get like these overlapping, each doing their own thing, and like an Ivesian sort of palette, or is it more integrated?
You get a little of both. I mean, for example, each quartet has its own solo movement, but then there's also a lot of moments where it's sort of call and response, and then there is some Ivesian material overlapping on top of one another to create a little more cacophony. And then, again, like I said, we sort of come out of that as a unified ensemble, which is really quite lovely.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a really cool piece.
It is. It's great. Dan really knocked this one out of the park.
Well, the other work on the Sunday program will be just the quartet playing an early Beethoven quartet, one of his earliest, Opus 18, number 1, although I think it's actually the second he wrote. What can you tell us about this particular piece?
You know, Beethoven wrote this, his first set of quartets, when he was in his late 20s. And he was a little intimidated because Haydn and Mozart had written a lot of great music for string quartet. But he was just establishing himself as a serious composer. He was known more as a piano prodigy and a piano virtuoso. And he still had retained his hearing at this point, at least for Opus 18, number 1, which is, I actually think it was the third one written, but it's a lovely piece. I think when they numbered these pieces back then, they wanted to put their best foot forward. So he wrote them all, you know, more or less around the same time. But when they decided to publish it, they wanted the piece with the sort of catchiest opening theme and maybe the most beautiful slow movement. And that's a great way to start, because, you know, people would buy these editions of these quartets when they first came out, and they would read them in their salons or their homes. And so you wanted to get their attention right away. It's kind of like putting the title track of an album, you know, a pop album first.
Right.
So this, you know, at least in the mind of Beethoven and his publishers at the time, was the strongest way to open his set of six quartets. So it starts off with a little lighthearted unison theme and bursts into this kind of very positive, very sort of brimming with enthusiasm. But then the second movement, I think, maybe is the most interesting movement, because he's quoted saying that he wasn't quoted. Actually, a friend of his said that the second movement reminded him of the tomb scene from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. And Beethoven didn't disagree with that. And so it's actually quite dark and quite tragic. And it really is a huge contrast to that first movement, and frankly, huge contrast to the rest of the piece. So it, I think, really separates itself as a really spectacular moment in these Opus 18.
Well, why don't we hear a bit of that moment from the second movement of Beethoven's Opus 18, number 1, played by the Miro Quartet. That's music by the Miro Quartet, who will be playing that work this Sunday at 3 at the Lorton PAC on the University of Tulsa campus for Chamber Music Tulsa. My guest today is Joshua Gindel, the cellist for the Miro Quartet. And this is from one of that was an early recording. That was one of your first recordings, wasn't it?
It was early on in the group's life. It was about 10 or 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
It wasn't the earliest, but certainly, you know, we're going to be 20 years next year. So it was definitely in the first half of our career.
20 years, that's a long time, but when you think of the great string quartets, that's you're maybe approaching middle age, I guess.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we had going for us for many years is we had the same membership for almost 20 years, and that's unusual. There are a lot of groups that have existed and been around a long time, but generally that, you know, you had member changes every 5, 6, 8 years. And we recently now being 4 years ago, had our first member change, which was Sandy Yamamoto, our original second violinist, who is actually Daniel, our first violinist's wife, left the group because they have some children, and both of them traveling was becoming a little difficult. And Will Fedkenhoyer joined us. He played in a number of other professional string quartets, so he came with an enormous amount of experience. But yeah, that was our first member change in 20 years, and it was you know, sort of monumental for us. But it's been great.
What happens when somebody like that, when you know, obviously a beloved member of the group, because you know, married to one member, and
right,
and certainly part of this journey that you've been on, leaves. What's the process for the quartet?
Well, you know, we discussed it well before it happened, so we knew it was going to happen so that we could plan ahead. I mean, you know, we book concerts out usually 2 years in advance, so we had to figure out how we were going to handle those, whether Sandy was going to continue to play or if we were going to play with a sub, or just how our, you know, day-to-day career was going to be handled. But then there's the process of figuring out how we're going to replace that person. And I'd have to say that replacing the second violinist in a string quartet is the hardest position to replace, because they really act as the glue inside the group that keeps everything together. And Sandy was so brilliant at it that I have to admit being a little fearful around this change. So we reached out to some mentors of ours, and we, you know, just went through our sort of Rolodexes and tried to figure out who it was that we were going to consider for this job. And we held some very extensive auditions. We had a number of different sort of waves of auditions because we couldn't quite find what we were looking for. And Will was actually in a quartet playing first violin, and he was really perfectly happy. I mean, it was a good position for him, and he was, you know, he was content where he was, but he came out and read with us, and something just clicked among the four of us, and it just seemed to make a lot of sense. And Will had maybe even more confusion in his life, because not only was he joining a new quartet, but he was leaving another one without a first violinist. So there was a lot of scheduling, and we all had to be very both groups were very flexible around each other's schedule, to try to make the transition work as smoothly as we could.
It's kind of like replacing a member of a family, I would think.
It's hard. It was very, very difficult, yeah.
Well, I know the Muro continues to be very busy premiering new works. You had a new premiere, I guess, last year, was it right, with the Gunther Schuller piece?
Yes. Last March we premiered his fifth string quartet.
And that must have been a great thrill because, you know, Gunther Schuller is just one of the names of classical music in America in the 20th century.
Yeah, he's iconic. We've had a relationship with Gunther for about 18 years. We recorded one of his pieces very early on. We were in year number 2 or 3 when we did it. And then we premiered another one of his works about 5 years ago. But we had never done a string quartet, there's a festival in Tucson Winter Chamber Music Festival, that basically put forth an opportunity for us to commission somebody, and Gunther was sort of an obvious choice. And he's iconic not only because he's a great composer, but he straddled every form of music you can imagine. He was, you know, principal horn player of two great symphony orchestras, top five in the country.
Right.
He played with Miles Davis. He recorded Miles Davis, and he was on...
Helped popularize Scott Joplin. I mean, all sorts of things.
He's a pedagogue and a conductor, and he's written books, and I mean, he's really exceptional, and we love him to death. We consider him a close friend of the quartets, and Gunther can also be a little rough around the edges, but we kind of appreciate that about him, so it was thrilling, and he was really, again, very happy with how the piece came out. and I'm happy about that because he is popular and he does write a lot of music still. He's almost 90, but he was particularly pleased with how this came out, and we've been playing it a lot lately, and I think the response has been very positive.
That's great. Well, I have to ask one last question because this is your lead on your bio, and I have to ask how this actually worked. But I understand you took up cello at age 3, playing a viola with an end cap.
With an end pin, yeah.
An end pin.
Yeah, when I was younger, my father came to all of his children and said, you know, as part of this family, you have to play something. And my dad was an amateur violinist, so I actually chose the violin at first. And I could do that. Actually, physically, I was a big kid, but, you know, at 3 years old, I decided I didn't like the violin. So I was in a Suzuki program, and my teacher actually was a cellist, my violin, Suzuki violin teacher. And so she said, why doesn't he try the cello? You know, he's a big kid. Let's give this a whirl and see how that feels. But the problem is, back then they didn't have the fractional cellos that they have now, the really small ones. So she actually retrofitted a viola with an end pin on it, because that was the only way to get me the strings. You know, obviously it's tuned the same pitches, it's just
right
up an octave.
Uh-huh.
So I could train myself to do everything I would do on a cello. It just sounded an octave higher. And so that was the instrument I played on for at least 6 or 8 months. It's amazing to think about now, because I have a 3-year-old daughter. And it's just astonishing to think about her playing anything, but let alone a viola with an end pin. But it was very industrious of her, and it apparently paid off, I guess.
I guess it is.
Yeah.
Now, you're all 4 of you are teaching and working with quartets and also teaching cello, in your case, teaching cello students at the University of Texas. Do you have a quartet in residence there with you now, or are you in between quartets, or what exactly?
No, we do. We have a really, really great group called the Cordova Quartet. They came to us from Rice University, and they're doing some extraordinary things. And I'd say that the thing that excites me the most about them, not only can they all really play, but they have that same spirit that the Aeolus had when they were here, that same drive and that same commitment to playing string quartets.
Well, we'll look forward to both the Miro and Aeolus Quartet this weekend. And you can see the Aeolus Quartet practically all over town this week, as they're doing performances all this week as a part of a residency for Chamber Music Tulsa. Joshua, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joshua Gendel, the cellist for the Miro Quartet, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The Miro Quartet will be joined by the Aeolus Quartet in a special concert from Chamber Music Tulsa Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center, playing works together by Welker and Mendelssohn. And the Miro will also play the Beethoven Quartet No. 1. For information on that concert, as well as some information on some open rehearsals and the Aeolus Quartet week-long residency with free concerts throughout the city, visit chambermusictulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.